Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. There are over 330 million people living in the United States, and every person is unique and different. From our political and environmental views, our interest in sports and music, to our work ethics and family values. But there is one thing that each and every one of us shares in common: food. We need it to survive, and too much of the wrong type of it can make us sick. Dr. Marion Nestle, America's leading food activist, joins us to discuss food politics and more. And it all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is the author of six award-winning books, including Food Politics, Pet Food Politics, and her latest, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. She has appeared in the documentary film Super Size Me, Food Fight, The Inside Story of the Food Industry, Killer at Large, and Fed Up. She's been named by Time Magazine, Science Magazine, and The Guardian as among the top 10 most influential people in health and science. She brings needed light to the dark side of the food business, helping consumers reclaim their health. Welcome to the show, one of my very favorite authors, Dr. Marion Nestle.
Oh, glad to be here.
Oh, it's so good to have you. You know, you're known for revealing the hidden politics, lobbyists, and biased research behind food industry. I spell that B-U-Y-A-S-E-D. So many people believe if it's sold in stores, Doc, it's gone through a stringent microscope by the FDA and deemed safe. But that's not always the case. Share with us how we can be more proactive in doing more due diligence on what we put into our mouths.
Well, the basic rules of healthy eating are really quite simple. You eat a lot of fruits and vegetables and don't eat too much junk food and balance calories. It's really not any more complicated than that. It's just that it's really hard for people to do that in the face of the kind of relentless pushing of food and marketing of food that we have in this country. So as far as safety goes, the most important thing is not to have pathogenic bacteria or viruses in your food. If you're worried about those, cook. Cooking solves a lot of problems in food safety. You know, you can count on the government for doing quite a bit to force the food industry to produce food more safely, and there have been enormous improvements in the regulations, and to the extent that companies follow them, they're doing just fine.
Right. I know you've rolled back the curtain revealing shocking information regarding the food industry. I'm curious, what was something that you learned during your research that made your jaw drop in disbelief?
Well, my jaw drops in disbelief all the time at the kinds of things I see. And and I shouldn't be so shocked anymore, but sometimes it's hard to get your head around the idea that food companies are about profits. They're not about public health. Their job is to make money for their stockholders, to improve shareholder value, to grow their profits so they can report growth to Wall Street every 90 days. And public health is way, way, way down on the list of the priorities for food companies. And you think that because they're making a product that you need in order to live, or that you love to eat because you just love it, you don't think of it as being something that's just selling widgets of one kind or another. And I think where I get shocked more than anything else is when I see the blatant, explicit putting priorities on profits over public health, and I see actions that do that without any paying attention to public health at all. I do find that shocking.
Yeah, I know you put sugar consumption as public enemy number one when it comes to the nation's poor health and obesity epidemic. In your book, you actually shared a tidbit that surprised me, made my mouth drop. 50% of the nation's sugar consumption comes from beverages, the majority being sodas. So if everyone in the nation simply gave up sugar beverages, would doctors end up bored twiddling their thumbs all day?
Oh, yeah, but they would be doing a lot more twiddling than they're doing now. I mean, if you're worried about your weight or your health, the first thing you do is you stop drinking sugary beverages. Even sugars in the form of candy are better for you than sugar in liquid form like that, because it goes into the body so quickly. We're really not evolutionarily equipped to deal with such large amounts of sugar coming into the body so quickly all at once.
Yeah, and I know you and I share the same pet peeve when it comes to sodas and how they're marketed heavily to children and teens. By getting kids hooked on sodas early, I guess it translates to increased profits, but what can parents do to pacify their kids' need for sugary fizzy drinks?
Well, I don't think kids need sugary fizzy drinks. There's no need for them at all. You can do quite well on a diet without having them at all. I think homes should be soda-free zones.
Right.
There's so much sugary beverage being given to very young children that the Department of Agriculture statistics can measure it, and dentists see the results all the time. People put their kids to bed with bottles full of soft drink, which is not very good for your teeth, amongst other things. And that, I think, has come about because sodas were marketed not as a special treat that you have once in a while. You're allowed to have one small soda on a Saturday, the way many of us were brought up as kids. But now you're supposed to drink sodas as a substitute for water, and the pressure to drink as much of it as you possibly can and to sell as much of it as the companies possibly could, making them in larger and larger containers is, I think, in part responsible for a lot of ill health in America.
That's wild. Now, you know, there's been a lot of new fads out there, ranging from gluten-free, grain-free, low-carb, eat like a caveman to eating only plant-based diets. I'm curious, because you're the research queen, is there any specific eating plan that you advocate and follow?
Yeah, I advocate a largely, not necessarily exclusively, plant-based diet. I mean, there's so much evidence that shows that people who eat their veggies are healthier than people who don't, that it seems like a really great first step. So you take out the soft drinks and start trying to put more vegetables into your diet and other kinds of plant foods, and that will make a big difference.
Yeah, I know that's you and I have the same. We're on the same plate there, to use that pun. But I agree. I think that there's a majority. I'm an 80% plant-based diet eater, and then 20% animal. So it's kind of like, you know, the paleo and the vegans, I'm kind of like somewhere in the middle like you. Is there one that's healthier than the other, though? Is like studies of people in general, is vegans considered healthier?
Well, I think people who eat a lot of plant foods in their diet tend to be healthier. But one of the really interesting things about diets is the range of dietary patterns that's associated with good health. You know, the classic healthy diets were the traditional diets consumed in Japan that were largely rice-based, therefore carbohydrate, and refined carbohydrate at that because it was white rice. And then you look at the Mediterranean diet, which had a lot of fat in it from olive oil, also very healthy, an enormous range of carbohydrate and fat intake promotes excellent health as long as the calories are balanced and there are vegetables in the diet. So there's a lot of leeway, and there are a lot of different ways of eating that are delicious and wonderful. Food's one of life's greatest pleasures, and you don't want to do anything that's going to detract from the deliciousness of food.
Yeah, so true. You know, I have so many patients blame genetics on why they're overweight or unhealthy, and the generations before us didn't have the obesity problem we have today, so how can we blame our DNA? That's my way of looking at it.
Well, we can blame our DNA in a couple of ways. One is that even though people are eating more now, and that's the explanation for obesity, it's really pretty simple. People are eating a lot more now than they did in the early 1980s or earlier. From the standpoint of body weight, some people gain weight faster than others when they overeat. So that's where genetics comes in. Some people are immune to eating, seem to be immune to eating lots of calories. They compensate by being more active, and they don't even think about it. It just happens. And for some people, just being in the room with food puts on makes them put on weight, or at least that's how they feel. So that's where genetics comes in, but everybody is eating more. Absolutely everybody across the board. And part of that is because portion sizes are bigger. So if you eat out in a restaurant, you're going to be eating a lot more food than you would have if you'd eaten out in a restaurant 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's such a good point. So basically, if our great-grandmas were alive today eating the food, they would be overweight, even though maybe they weren't overweight back then.
Well, they would be eating more. You know,
right.
If I had one concept that I could get across to everybody, it's that larger portions have more calories. I can't even say it with a straight face because it sounds so completely ridiculous, but it's not intuitively obvious,
right,
as it turns out. And we're hardwired. Humans are hardwired in some way not to understand that if you eat bigger portions, you're going to be taking in more calories, and if you eat more calories, you're going to be gaining weight.
Makes sense. It's such an easy concept, and people just, I think what it is a lot of these chemicals make them starving for more, or maybe they're what's called empty calories that makes them crave more potato chips. You can't eat just one.
Well, these foods are engineered to make people like them. That's what they do, and people buy them and don't think about the calories or anything else that's in them, and start eating them, and they like the way it feels on your teeth and the crunch and all of those other things. And before long, you've taken in a lot of calories. If you're doing that with a small amount, it makes no difference at all.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with an occasional soda or an occasional bag of potato chips if it's not too big.
Makes sense. So in small increments makes sense. I love that you use these same principles to raise awareness about pet food. And, you know, most people are diehard animal, people food, and they don't kind of go to the other side. But, you know, a lot of people are eating organically now. They're reading labels, yet they feed their pets food without the same criteria. What should pet owners know about the food they buy for their cats and dogs?
Oh, well, I have very bad news if you think that there are differences. Because pet foods are regulated in exactly the same way that infant formulas are regulated, there is a formula, and all pet foods have to meet that formula for the nutritional value. If they say they're complete and balanced, all of them have exactly the same or enough of the same kinds of things in them that they're virtually identical, one to the other. I mean, you can think they're all made from byproducts. Every single pet food is made from byproducts, whether it's called human grade or any other kind of grade. It's all byproducts of human food production. And in that way, pet food's very useful, because otherwise a lot of it would be wasted. And so this is one really useful thing that you can do with the waste products from human food production. But they're all nutritionally equivalent. And you can buy the cheapest one, and your pet ought to be just as well off as if you're buying the most expensive one. I've never seen any research that compares the health effects of the cheapest complete and balanced pet foods to the most expensive ones, because nobody wants to do that kind of research.
Yeah, that's interesting. Something I didn't realize. You know, in your books, you really show there's a lot of manipulation, and that's spelled M-O-N-E-Y, when it comes to organizations we rely on for guidance. For example, the American Heart Association once endorsed Cocoa Puffs and Frosted Mini Wheats as being heart healthy. Of course, General Mills and Kellogg's were part of the paid-for heart healthy certification program. Doc, how can we trust health organizations when money is so often the root of their opinions?
Well, that's a really difficult problem. I mean, I think you have to think for yourself. And if what a company or a heart association or a health organization is saying sounds too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. And you can look and see if there's, if you had looked at those labels that the American Heart Association had on those food products in the old days, you would have seen that they were only looking at the fat content. They didn't care about sugar at all.
Right.
So if it met the criteria for fat, then it didn't make any difference. So you have to read those things carefully and think that if there's any kind of advice that's coming in that isn't telling you to worry about calories and vegetables, there's probably something wrong with it.
Something wrong with it. So again, use your common sense. That's really key.
Always.
Keep the antennas up. Don't be so trusting, you know. Use your little sixth sense that you've got. And so many people ignore that. That's so true.
Yeah, critical thinking. When it comes to marketing, critical thinking is very helpful.
So true. Now, a lot of our listeners may not realize, but during the Reagan administration, you helped write the Surgeon General's report on nutrition and health. I understand you were told not to share any detrimental information on meat and dairy because these foods were under the protection of the Department of Agriculture. Was this the first time you realized dirt was being swept under the carpet?
Well, I had my suspicions, but I went to Washington really quite naively. And that was kind of a shock for the first, I mean, talk about jaw-dropping on my first day on the job. I was told that no matter what the research showed, this report would never say eat less meat, because if it did, the Department of Agriculture would complain to Congress, and Congress would prevent the report from coming out. That was in the Reagan administration, which seemed very conservative at the time. Now it seems like a bastion of liberality. But even then, there was the Department of Agriculture's function is to protect American commodity agriculture. And it was just doing its job.
You know, and as you said, it's basically putting profits before people. I know in the 1988 Surgeon General C. Everett Koop was quoted as saying, diet is the contributing factor for high blood pressure, obesity, dental disease, osteoporosis, GI diseases, and a major cause of death in America. But, Doc, that wasn't covered in the media. However, the same year, a San Francisco earthquake made national headlines because it killed 67 people. Nothing compared to the many thousands that died prematurely that year from their diet. So my question is, with all the money involved, does the government want us to be sick?
Well, you know, I used to ask a very cynical question. Now lots of people are asking the same question, and that was, what industry in the United States would prosper if Americans ate more healthfully? And I was hard-pressed to come up with any of them until somebody told me about Kaiser Permanente, which is a big health maintenance organization on the West Coast that is nonprofit and right. Very, very concerned about preventing illness because it costs them more to take care of sick people than it does to take care of healthy people. You would think everybody would want to do that, but that's not how the system works.
Jeez, yeah, it's an eye opener. I know in your book you shared astronomical. I didn't realize that the amount of money that's being spent on advertising. Coca-Cola alone spends $250 million a year in the U.S. to make their product a household name. How can people compete with these daily bombarding messages everywhere from Facebook, social media, TV, radio?
Well, the competition is pretty severe, as it turns out, because sales of Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola are way, way down in the United States. They've been falling for 15 years at least. The soda industry thinks that's because of health messages and health advocacy. I'm not going to argue with them. I'll
Right.
take credit for that. Why not? But sales are way down. The message is out. Just through advocacy work, that drinking sugary drinks isn't good for you, and lots of people have heard that message.
Yeah, the news is definitely out. I've got to ask you, you're one of America's food advocates' favorites for decades. During that time that you've been writing, you've seen Whole Foods Market come to play, Trader Joe's hit the nation, non-GMO movements, and a huge increase in food documentaries. Has all this new awareness helped stifle any of the profits before people practices that you've witnessed over the last three decades, or is it the same?
Well, it's not exactly the same. It's just shifted. So that, I mean, companies are, once again, in the business of selling products. That's their job. If they don't sell products, they get into trouble. They get bought out. They have to sell. Their CEOs get fired. I mean, all these really terrible things happen to them. Their job is to sell profits. Their job is not to promote public health. If they can use public health as a way to sell products, they'll do that to the extent that they can. It's harder for some foods than others, but that's why you see so many foods in the supermarket with health claims that they're no trans fat, no GMOs, no additives, no whatever. The food may still be high in sugar and salt, but it isn't going to have those other things, and it will have this health aura that will help it sell products. So they will use public health to sell products and to the extent that that works. But then behind the scenes, they are still lobbying Congress to make sure that no laws are passed that will interfere with sales or raise their costs. They are funding research to come out exactly the way they want it so they can argue that their products are healthy, harmless, or that any evidence to the contrary is so badly done that you can just not pay any attention to it. And they are defending their product sales in every possible way. That's their job.
That's their job. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with us. You know, you really, with your books, have put a microscope right up in front of this food industry that is so needed. Like I said, one of my very favorite authors, so it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure to be here.
That's great. To learn more about Dr. Marion Nestle's books, go to foodpolitics.com. While you're there, make sure you sign up for her free newsletter and read her informative blog post. I read them and highly recommend that you do too. You can follow her on Twitter at Marion Nestle, that's spelled N-E-S-T-L-E. And for my daily health tweets, follow me at Dr. David Friedman. Stay up to date on all of our latest health and wellness segments at toyourgoodhealthradio.com, radiomd.com, iHeartRadio, or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.